And welcome back to Undisclosed Unfiltered. Rabia here, and I'm joined with Colin and Mithal. Hey, guys.
How's it going?
Hello, hello.
We are all on kind of on the other side of a snowpocalypse, except apparently there's another storm coming in a few days. How y'all doing?
Trying to survive.
Yeah, we're okay down here in South Carolina. It's not too bad.
The South. This is why I need to move down south. I'm just so, it's not even like we actually only got about like less than a foot of snow, but I feel like I'm stuck in the Alps. So I don't know why. I think I'm just not used to it anymore. And I do not like shoveling. And anyway, I keep thinking I could be in Miami. I just want to get out of here. But anyway, look, things could be worse. Thankfully, we didn't lose electricity. And anyhow, all of you listening, I hope you were in the storm path. You got through it okay and safely. And and fingers crossed for this weekend. But we are here to talk about, I don't know, whatever we want to talk about, kind of like what's jumping out at us from the news in the law and true crime and law-related things. So Colin, Mithal, and I have our stories. We never know what we're going to talk about. Nope. Right? We just kind of pop on, and Colin especially likes to surprise us. So, but I'm going to go first today, just because I want to summon the strength to get through this. And look, since the last time we recorded this, another person has been murdered by ICE on camera. And I want to talk a little bit about this. I don't even want to talk about the actual incident. On January 24th, Alex Preti, it's Preti, I believe is how his last name is pronounced, was murdered in Minneapolis as he was filming an ICE operation in which somebody was being detained. He was shot. There were 10 shots fired within 5 seconds. I am not at all going to entertain any conversation or debate about whether he was a danger or a threat or had a gun. We have seen all kinds of crazy stuff come out of the administration and certain pundits, because multiple angles and many witnesses, multiple angles of video footage of the incident and many witnesses have shown us, that he was holding a phone and he wasn't doing any, he was holding a phone. He was filming, which he was absolutely entitled to do. The incident, a woman near him was shoved by an ICE agent and he would try to protect her. I mean, you can go frame by frame, but he was then pepper sprayed and then tackled immediately. And within seconds of being tackled, he was shot point blank in the back of his head. And then I don't know, a whole clip was fired into him, 10 shots in 5 seconds. And so that's it. He was murdered. It's simple as that. I don't feel like there's really nothing to debate here. Simple, right? And I've seen over and over, you know, he was a U.S. citizen. First of all, it wouldn't have mattered. It wouldn't have mattered what his immigration status was in that moment. He was well within his right. He was not interfering with the operation. There was nothing he was doing. But what I want to talk about is people are so confused as to what to do in these situations. Like, how do we deal with ICE agents? Now, there's been a huge explosion of hirings by the administration. There are tens of thousands of ICE agents now that did not exist, you know, maybe 6 months ago, a year ago. And they're moving from, you know, different places. I believe that they are increasing operations in Boston. And I don't know, like I keep hearing, you know, I know there's some operations here in the DMV. We did see a lot of agents a few months ago in D.C. and then they kind of disappeared. I haven't seen them in a while, but I've gotten reports that we're seeing more in Maryland and from part to Maryland. So, you know, what do you do? What are your rights? And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about in this, you know, in this climate. What are your rights? So, and you know, there's also debate about ICE agents actually police? No, they're not the police, but they are federal law enforcement. There's no way around that. They are federal law enforcement. But like any law enforcement officer who approaches you, you don't actually have to respond. You can exercise your right to remain silent. It does not matter your immigration status. Everybody in the United States has that right. You can say, I choose to remain silent, or I choose to speak to my lawyer, or both. And if you do that, then stay silent after that. Don't run away. Don't resist. Don't try to drive your car away. Even if you think your rights are being violated, try to keep your hands where they can see you at all times. If they ask you for documents and you want to provide the documents, you're willing to provide the documents, then you tell them, I'm now going to reach for my glove compartment. I'm going to reach for my back pocket. I'm going to reach for this to get the papers, to make sure that there's no movement on your part that would cause them to feel threatened. You can also not give them any documents. You actually do not have to provide any proof of your citizenship or nationality or immigration status. Now, there's a little distinction here. Federal law does require, if you are not a U.S. citizen, if you're a U.S. citizen, you're actually not required to run around with your citizenship papers. There's no federal requirement. Federal law does require that if you're a green card holder, meaning a permanent resident, if you are an immigrant with a visa, that you have those documents on you. But even then, it does not require that you have to produce them. Now, you can make the judgment in that moment. Look, I don't want to deal with this. I just want to show them my papers so I can get along, go on my way. And in that case, if you are a U.S. citizen, what you should do, and I mean, I had a book club a few days ago, and a bunch of friends came over to my place, and one of them, who is a very prominent author, an award-winning author in this country, was showing us all how she carries copies now of her passport and this and that, and naturalization papers. And that's the right thing to do, is not turn over your original passport to an agent, because guess what? They could get rid of it.
Right.
They could just take it and chuck it. It could disappear. But have copies if you are open to showing them. But again, you don't have to. What you cannot do, however, is don't lie about your status. You can either stay quiet, you can tell the truth, you can show documents if you want. You don't have to. You can also ask, am I being arrested or detained? And this is like in any kind of law enforcement encounter. Am I being arrested or detained? If they say no, I mean, you can keep asking the question. If they don't respond, you have to like probably just kind of hang out until they do. But if they say no, then you are entitled to actually walk away. So what about if they want to search you or search your car or search your home? Now, if they show up at your home, they have to have a judicial warrant to enter that home. There's different warrants. There's administrative warrants that ICE often uses, but judicial warrant is what's required to enter your home. It's signed by a judge. If you are at the door and ICE is on the other side, do not open the door. Talk to them through a window. Talk to them through the door. If you have two doors, like a storm, like don't open any of the doors. Just talk to them. If they say they have a judicial warrant, tell them to, hold it up to the window, slide it under the door, whatever, like somehow to get it to you without actually opening the door. When you open the door, they can construe that as you're allowing them to come inside. You have the right to refuse to be searched. If you're out somewhere, you have the right to say, like, they cannot search your car without probable cause or again, a warrant. And you can say no. You can say, and you should say, I do not consent to a search. They can still search, but at least you have, like, asserted your right. And I would document that too, if possible, which takes me to how do you document? You are entitled, in fact, you can film these encounters as long as you're not interfering in any kind of an operation or detention that's taking place. You are allowed, and I would encourage you, and as many people who might be passersby or standing around to film. I mean, if you look at what happened with Renee Good and with Alex Pretty, thankfully, there's so much footage, right, of witnesses that we have to counter really the propaganda that we're getting from the administration. But that's one way to document it, is to make that video and say on video, I do not consent to a search or whatever, and to say, assert your whatever, I want to stay silent, or I want to talk to a lawyer. That's one way to document it. Another way, if you can't do that, is to just try to write things down, ask for the names, badge numbers, write down the time that this is happening, the date it's happening, anything you hear them say, write it down. So have some kind of documentation of whatever's going on. Let's say if you do get detained, you do have the right to contact an attorney. If you don't have a lawyer, you can tell them, I need a lawyer. You can say, give me a, I want a list of pro bono lawyers. Now, I would say if you are kind of high risk in this situation, high risk is somebody obviously who is not documented or who might be under in some kind of process to get documented. And at this point, it feels like anybody who they think is an immigrant could be high risk. But anyway, it is a good idea to have on you at all times a G28 form that's signed by an attorney. A G28 form is it's the form used in immigration proceedings for an attorney to show that I represent this person. And so even if you don't have a lawyer because you don't have anything kind of pending in court, you might want to contact an immigration attorney and say, I just want somebody that I can contact if I get detained or somebody I know gets detained. Would you agree to represent me and provide me with a G28 and have that G28 form ready to give to agents or federal law enforcement? If you are a foreign national and you're detained by ICE, you actually have the legal right to contact your country's consulate or ask the officer to inform the consulate of your detention. The consulate can help sometimes with getting you a lawyer or just helping your family figure out where you are. After 9/11 happened, it was about a year or 2 years after. It was, I think, the year after 9/11. I can't remember, 2002 maybe. This program called Special Registration was launched by the newly formed Department of Homeland Security. And there were 27 countries that were identified. And I was still in law school at the time, but I had 27 countries were identified. And if you are a male between the ages of 17 and 70 from any one of those countries as an immigrant, it didn't matter if you had a green card, didn't matter if you were here on an H-1B visa, didn't matter if you're a student, but anyhow, you had to go and report to ICE. You had to go and report to DHS. You could not take a lawyer. You could not take family members. Many thousands of people, in order to comply with this, went and were never seen again. We did not know where they went. And at that time, I was working with the consulate of Pakistan. They contacted me and said, we don't really have a lot of lawyers like from our community, but we need help trying to just find people because ICE can detain you. Immigration could detain you one place and ship you off to a whole different corner of the country. They can even put you in general population prisons. And then the families are left wondering, where are they? And we see this a lot nowadays because we're seeing stories of people they don't know. They know people got detained. They have no idea where they are. All right. So I think that's about it. Is there anything you guys can think of or any kind of questions you guys might have that I might not have covered? These are scary, obviously, encounters, but, you know, stay calm. Don't be belligerent. I've seen videos of people, and I get it. I get the anger, cussing and calling them names. I don't think it serves anybody in that situation. I think you want to be calm, respectful, assert your rights, and document what's going on.
I mean, I think what's scary about it is that so many of the people are being calm, right? Are not necessarily resisting or fighting back or anything, and they're still hurt, you know, whether in this case he was shot or, you know, something else. And that's scary, right? You do all the right things. This list of stuff that you just said in terms of make sure you do, you know, check all these boxes. Okay, great, I did it. But somehow I was still violated, you know?
I completely agree with you. There's nothing that Alex Preddy, I didn't see anything that he did wrong in this situation. He was not interfering with the actual ongoing operation, which was like not even it was like across the street or something that he was filming. He did react to the woman getting shoved, and you can tell he's just kind of trying to protect her and get in between them. And when he's pepper sprayed, you know, I was thinking about this because I saw this one commentator say, well, look, he was resisting arrest. They pushed him down and he was struggling. Can you imagine getting pepper sprayed and not struggling? I mean, that's your body reacting to being pepper sprayed. It's not even that you're just trying to probably breathe at that point.
Right.
Not necessarily fight the people who are detaining you. This man was a nurse with the VA, you know, I mean, it's not like, and frankly, all the people going out there who are acting as legal observers and, you know, most of them are probably people who are citizens, who have clean records, who do not have a lot of law enforcement encounters, because people who do or have some kind of, you know, high risk situation probably will not be out there doing it, right? Like, so, yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say. You're right, Mito. It's not that he was doing anything wrong in that situation. And that's why I was like, I'm not even debating that this was he was murdered, basically. Yeah. All right. Anything else you guys want to? Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. Mital, are you going to keep your papers with you? I haven't done that yet. You're naturalized, defiance, right?
Out of defiance, no.
Out of defiance, yeah.
I've thought about it, but probably not.
Why not? Yeah. Yeah, I kind of feel the same way, too.
I mean, hearing that it's close to home, you know, being in Howard County, for example, like, that's like, ugh, come on.
And most of the time, I think the risk would be, look, we both live in these quiet suburbs. They're not going to be ICE operations in our burbs. It would be like if we're driving down the highway and, like, they're literally setting up checkpoints and stuff in certain, or, you know, there are places I like to shop, like, let's say Tacoma Park and stuff that are heavily immigrant, populated. Yep. They're very dense. They might be hanging out there. They might be at the Home Depot, whatever, things like that. But it's kind of like, you know, we can assert that we are U.S. citizens, and U.S. citizens do not have to carry their papers, and then let the chips fall where they may. I kind of don't feel like living in that way where I got to show my papers. Now, in many states also, in order, I mean, like, I don't know, like, I don't know how many states, but in a lot of states, just to get your driver's license, you have to show that you have some kind of, your immigration status, you have some kind of legal residence in America. So showing the driver's license should be good enough. Right. Like, it should be enough to show an ICE agent.
You would think.
That, yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, that's our little act of resistance then, Mithil.
Well, me. And I wear my immigrant t-shirt too. So there's that.
Might not go that far. All right. I will move this to Mithil then.
Okay.
Mithil, what do you want to talk about this week?
So I want to talk about a case that I'm sure many people have heard about because it's from a couple of years ago. And actually, one of our listeners suggested that we cover it. It's the Aaron Spencer case out of Arkansas. You guys are familiar with that?
Maybe? Yeah. In fact, we just recorded a bonus episode for Patreon yesterday, and we did talk about it briefly, but we haven't really gotten into it.
Okay. So let's do it. So this actually takes place back in 2024, October 8th, 2024, around 1 o'clock in the morning, a father by the name of Aaron Spencer realizes that his daughter is missing. She's not in bed. She's not in the house. So he immediately jumps in his truck and starts driving around, looking for her, and happens to locate her in a truck with a man. He forces the man's truck off the road, confronts him, and during their altercation, Spencer ends up shooting his gun 16 times and ultimately kills the man. He then proceeds to call 911 and say, you know, here's what just happened. And, you know, I killed this man, but I was protecting my daughter. He was obviously arrested and eventually charged with second degree murder. But just maybe a week or two later, he's released on a $150,000 bond. Mm-hmm. And then his trial date is set for January 2026. So this month. This is in October of 24. Now, fast forward a couple of months, in December of 2024, the judge issues a gag order to the lawyers and the family because she doesn't want the jewelry pool to be tainted. Mm-hmm. And that's that. Then, you know, we wait until January 2026. Seems like a fairly straightforward case, but of course it's not. Because the man that Aaron Spencer killed wasn't a random stranger. He actually knew the guy because they've got history. The man's name is Michael Fossler, and he was a registered sex offender who happened to be out on bond when he was caught with the teenager. He's facing about 40 plus charges related to sexual crimes against that same teenage girl, and he had a no contact order. So because of that history, you know, the dad's claiming he was protecting her, and his daughter's already been violated. And so he's like, you know what? I can't rely on law enforcement or the courts to get her justice. So I'm just trying to keep her safe. Then fast forward about a year from that time, it's October of 2025. And Aaron Spencer, the dad, decides, you know what? I'm going to fix the system from within. And he launches a campaign to become the county sheriff. He's got tons of supporters. Sorry.
Does he have a law enforcement background?
He's an army vet. He's a farmer. He's got tons of supporters, you know, obviously because of what happened. And then he's a farmer, right? So smaller community. And he's like, you know, so many of you families around here have been failed by the system. So I'm going to be your voice, and I'm going to fix all this from within. But on the other hand, there is tons obviously opposing this campaign because he's charged with a murder and he hasn't even gone to trial yet. So, and actually, according to the prosecution, this wasn't his first altercation with Michael Fossler. There was another time where some deputies had kind of warned him not to take the law into his own hand and let the system do its thing. And so the prosecution is suggesting that this was a premeditated murder. Obviously, if he's found guilty, then he can't hold public office. But what's crazy is the timing of all of this, right? So now we're in current times. It's January, the original trial date, January 26th, just a few days ago. But what ends up happening is the defense files a petition requesting that that judge be removed and the gag order. The Arkansas Supreme Court decides to intervene last Friday, the 23rd, and they make a ruling vacating the gag order, remove the judge, and put a stay on the trial date.
Oh, wow.
All this happened on Friday.
Wow.
And so instead of the 26th being, you know, when the original trial date is, what happens on the 26th of January is they've assigned a new judge, and they brought this judge out of retirement so that he's now assigned to the case. They don't have a new trial date yet. So now we'll see kind of when that ends up falling. But the primary for this sheriff campaign is scheduled for March 3rd, 2026. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's ironic is there's already obviously a sheriff in town, and he's been there since 2013, excuse me.
Oh, wow.
And so he's also looking to be reelected. He's the one who arrested Aaron Spencer. Hmm. So, you know, it's like if the trial date is not set or if it doesn't start and if he's not convicted or whatever ends up happening before March 3rd, he could become sheriff.
He could be the sheriff.
Huh? Yeah. He could be the sheriff. Hmm. So. What are your thoughts on that? You know, is he vigilante dad, or is he just the ideal sheriff because, you know, he's actually genuinely looking to change the system because of his experience? Should he be able to run for office while pending trial? You know,
have you heard about Donald Trump? I mean, because
that was in the back of my mind. It was.
Yeah. Colin, what do you think? What do you think about the fact? Let's say he wins, he becomes sheriff, and then he is convicted.
Well, that's obviously a problem.
Yeah.
And the question that we discussed a bit, Robbie, on the Patreon episode is, will he be convicted? And I think this is clearly a case where the defense is going to argue for jury nullification. Mm. Jury nullification meaning a jury has a power to find a defendant not guilty despite guilt being proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, Robbie, when we were discussing this, I think we were on the same page where I'm mostly against jury nullification. I think it's dangerous and has the potential to have some really guilty and heinous people being absolved. But in this case, his daughter was 13, 14 years old. This is, I think he's 67 years old.
Yep.
Yeah.
Fossler. And he had done this before to the daughter. They had a no contact order. This is after midnight. He has her in the truck or the car. And so, I mean, this is probably the rare case where as a juror, I would nullify, and I don't really like
to find him guilty.
Yeah, I don't like people taking the law into their own hands. It is a bit of a vigilante dad, but like in this case, I understand, and I would have a really tough time convicting as a juror.
I completely understand. I would 100% be the juror who says, "I know you killed him, not guilty." However, I'm actually surprised because Colin, I always thought that if anything, Colin's going to be like, no, we got to be by the book.
It's the fact there's a no, if this were the first time he saw it, that's different. Like this tried to follow the law, had a no contact order. This guy was obviously violating it, and it's after midnight. Like, I understand.
I mean, I guess there's over 40 charges against him. You know what I mean? That's crazy. Related to the girl. Who? Against Osler, related to this girl specifically.
Okay. So, I mean, it's very likely. I mean, first of all, I'm guessing he has a lot of popular local support.
Indeed.
And the jury's going to come from people. I mean, how do you, I don't know, as a prosecutor, I'd be like, I don't know. I feel like almost a prosecutor has to be like, you know what, we're going to maybe go for a lesser charge. Maybe we have to rethink this, you know. Prosecution, because I can't imagine like being able to find a jury really, from of his peers that would actually convict him.
Yeah.
So it's very likely not only that he will become sheriff, but also he'll beat the charges.
We'll see.
Yeah. And I guess I'm okay with all of that. That's a terrible thing. You know, the thing about jury nullification, I did not know this really, or maybe I just don't remember from law school, is when Colin explained to me yesterday that it's not like this formal thing where the jury is given the option of you can find him guilty, not guilty, or factually guilty, but act legally not guilty. No, it's just something that they can choose to exercise. But Colin, can't a judge overturn, can a judge be like, I'm not accepting it?
A judge can do it the other way. If the jury
Oh.
finds the defendant guilty, the judge can act as the so-called 13th juror and reverse that. A judge can't overrule a not guilty verdict and impose a conviction. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, already I feel like the tide has turned against the prosecution. So it doesn't look like it's gonna do great, but it's an interesting story. It will make a great movie when it's finally done, because you know it's gonna happen. All right, Colin, what do you have to share with us this week?
All right, so the number one movie at the box office this weekend was called Mercy. It is set in dystopian future LA. Chris Pratt plays an LAPD detective
Oh,
who,
I wanted to see
it
this.
just came out, yeah,
Oh, okay.
he helps to create this artificial intelligence judge played by Rebecca Ferguson. Where it's instead of a trial by jury, you go before the AI judge and they decide. You try to prove your innocence. The prosecution tries to prove your guilt. And he ends up charged with the murder of his wife. And so now he who helped invent this AI judge has to protest his innocence to that judge. And so, you know, it seems like the realm of Philip K. Dick sci-fi, we wouldn't have it. But as I was telling my students yesterday, we have it. In a certain sense, and that is in the pretrial release versus detention decision. And so in about 60 jurisdictions, states, cities, counties, they use this algorithm. It's known as PSA, public safety assessment. It was an algorithm based upon looking at 750,000 historical cases, and they have nine factors: your age, criminal history, appearances or non-appearances at other court dates, et cetera. And the algorithm spits out, you know, bail, no bail, conditions of release, et cetera. Now the judge can overrule the algorithm, but the algorithm is the starting point to decide whether to impose bail, amount, et cetera. Some say this is great. Studies show that judges have higher or lower bail or arbitrary decisions based upon did their favorite sports team win or lose the prior day? Is the weather nice? There are racial disparities. And they say, algorithm, unbiased.
Yeah.
This is a good addition. I'm quoting here from the Bail Project, the other side, where they say these algorithms are built on outdated, limited, and biased data that has worked because of racial disparities in policing, charging, and case outcomes. The algorithms incorporate the same biases as our existing criminal justice system, many formed through decades of systematic oppression against disadvantaged communities, particularly communities of color. And so, you know, Ravi and Yuthal, what I am wondering, and this, you know, Maryland does something like this. New Jersey, I guess, is the biggest jurisdiction in the state overall using algorithms. But, you know, what's your thought about algorithms, either pre-trial or at trial or AI? Should we have just, it's the judge and the jury at a trial, and that's it? Are algorithms useful to sort of give you a starting point? Might it make sense to have an algorithm actually deciding bail decisions as opposed to a judge and actually supplanting the judge because the judge can be biased? What are your thoughts about the use of AI and algorithms in pretrial release decisions?
I think every week you pose these really complicated ethical questions to us, Colin, that I've never thought about before. It seems to make much better sense, to have an algorithm versus leaving these kinds of decisions to the discretion of a judge who might just be in a bad mood or have their own biases in many ways. But it's interesting to me. Do you know have more like information about what critics say are like the outdated kind of parameters that they're using? Because the things that you talked about seem fairly reasonable to me. I mean, like in terms of what they're assessing.
You have one defendant with a powder cocaine conviction and sentence,
Oh,
one
I
with
see.
crack cocaine. You have, someone who, after being stopped and frisked multiple times, more interactions with the law for certain communities versus others. And so algorithm just says, okay, this person was stopped and frisked 3 times and they had small amount of marijuana 10 years ago. And that's treated the same as someone else who, didn't have those same interactions based upon different factors.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, correcting for that kind of stuff, right? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, pretrial detention to me, and of course it can have such an impact on the outcome of a person's case, should kind of be determined whether, I mean, the entire determination would be like, is this person safe to be out in public or not, right? And we've seen people charged with murdering their families and they get bail. And then folks who obviously have like who have no previous violent convictions, like Adnan, not get denied bail. But I feel like if that's the only, I mean, I feel like the algorithm should only be about whether or not you have a previous violent conviction, not even a charge. Would that be sufficient? Do you think that would do it?
Well, so I'm the part of the question. This is one of the big things in the system is face to face, right? That judge seeing this accused and hearing from them. Is that subjectivity a good thing or a bad thing, Rabia? As you say, is it just the cold hard facts? Here's their age, here's their criminal
Well,
record,
yeah,
their
and
history,
now
appearances, or
I'm also
let's do this
thinking,
individual and
what if
hear what
this,
they have to say.
yeah, and I, as soon as I said it, I'm like, no, wait a minute, what about the serial killer who's only been caught after killing like three people or six people or whatever, right? Then what are you doing? Yeah, I don't, God, I don't know, Colin, what's the right answer? Mitha, what do you think?
I think the algorithm is a good idea, but I don't think it ends there. I think that's a great starting point. Maybe it's like a multi-tiered process. Just because since it can be so subjective for a judge, depending on his mood or, to your point, if his team lost or won, the data and being able to kind of process that, and here's like kind of here's the bottom line that I'm spitting out based on all this information, right? I think that's fair. I think that's a great starting point for a judge, but I don't think it ends right there. So AI judge who's simply, processing this data and then spitting out the answer based on the algorithm, I don't think that would cut it. And I mean, the point of having a jury is great because you have so many different perspectives making a decision versus one judge making a decision, right? So even that, like, I'm all about panel judges for all the things, or a jury. So I think the algorithm is a great idea. I think anything we can do to use data, but have a good amount of data, right? Not anything that's skewed or to your point, if it's jaded off to the side, like it's not going to be useful. Yeah, I would say more of like a tiered thing would make sense. Start with AI, but then end with people.
And so here's my question as a follow-up, which is, I've done a lot of research on what's called the anchoring effect. And the anchoring effect says whenever you have a decision or a negotiation, the first number or the first solution that's thrown out there is an anchor, and people underadjust down or up. If I go to a neighborhood kid and say, "Will you mow my lawn for $30?" They're going to anchor on that. If I say 40, they'll anchor on that. And so that could be a good thing or a bad thing because, if we have the algorithm and it's giving the judge the number, okay, bail set at 10K, et cetera, here are the conditions, and the judge anchors on that, they're, according to social science, not likely to deviate too much from that. But is that a good thing or a bad thing if that's the truth, that they're mostly relying upon the algorithm and then not making huge adjustments?
Well, we're just asking you to give us the answer, Colin. Because we don't.
Well, I mean, that's it gets back to the
I feel
question,
like,
right? Of like,
I mean,
I see this 23-year-old 4 years ago, he had a small amount of marijuana and it's illegal in this jurisdiction. And I could look at the algorithm or I can see this kid in front of me and see, you
Shouldn't
know.
something like that, a scenario like that, should like breeze by the algorithm? The algorithm should not count that as against the person. Is it a public safety threat that some kid's got some joints? I mean, like, no, it's not a public safety threat. Not the way that I don't think anybody, I don't think any reasonable member of the public would be like, lock it, do not let him out before his trial because he had a couple of
Right.
joints, you know,
And what if
years ago.
it's a battery conviction based upon getting in a fist fight with, you know, another 18-year-old in high school?
I mean, look, if you ha yeah, it's again, it's one of those things where like, what is he standing trial for now? Is he standing trial for passing a bad check and you're basing like denial of bail on this battery charge? Like, it just, I guess you do have to, you have, I think, yeah, I guess I agree with kind of the way it's set up now makes more sense where you have, it's a starting point, but then you have some human oversight. You know, to adjust and mitigate when necessary. Cause
Yeah,
I,
because I'm sorry, go
yeah.
ahead.
But like, I mean, I wonder, I mean, can AI get better at this? I mean, the trailer for this particular movie is terrifying,
I
right?
mean, obviously that's, I don't think we'll ever have a point where it's an AI judge. Well, knock wood, but you know.
I mean, the entire trial is done by AI, right? Like the evidence is presented. And first of all, lawyers will never allow that to happen because they need lawyers will never allow that to happen. They need the money. But you know, in a situation like this, I feel like, yeah, maybe AI tools should be, should, I mean, we should be at a point where they can just better assess like these kinds of issues versus like, you know, just check, you know, boxes and stuff like that.
One final question that a student raised in class, which I found really interesting, especially for judges who are elected. And we have these commercials, right? They let this killer go free, et cetera.
Yeah.
In the one sense, if the judge follows the algorithm, that's some cover. Well, yeah, I released this person with a $10,000 bond. That's what the algorithm recommended. That's some cover. But is it going to deter judges from deviating from the algorithm and having lighter conditions or release? Because then you can imagine the attack ads. The algorithm said, keep him locked up or set a high bail. The judge went lower or released this guy, and then he went out and killed someone or assaulted someone.
Yeah. What's the question? About like
Should that matter that it
the
could
judges?
mean that judges would be gun shy about being more lenient than the AI and the
I mean, I'm
algorithm
guessing they already are.
recommends?
I could be wrong here, but I'm guessing that judges will err towards the side of keeping people safe. Because, I mean, fundamentally, I don't know how aware judges are, frankly, as to like the effect of pretrial detention has on a person's ability to defend themselves. I really don't even know how educated they are about that. That's something that like we just talked about in criminal justice circles and advocates bring up. But I think generally speaking, judges will err towards the side of like not risking that. You know what I mean? And the politics of it and the optics of it, right? They of course they're going to have their self-interest at heart. And ultimately probably think, well, even if this guy has, you know, doesn't get, if I don't give him bail or whatever, then he'll still get a free trial. He'll still get a fair trial, right? Like, I don't know if they understand like the impacts of that. But I don't know. I don't know. What do you think, Colin? You're the only one who hasn't given an opinion yet.
I haven't done nearly as much research into this as other law professors have really focused upon this. I've done more on, which you probably have seen, the use of AI for identifying people who committed crimes, and the AI is much worse
Holy
with
moly.
people of color than it
Jeez.
is with white people because the database is so much smaller. And so
True.
you hear sort of every month, the AI said this guy did it and he's completely innocent. And so I'm just,
I did not know that AI was being used to identify people.
In fact, there, you know, Indiana passed a bill recently limiting the use of that. So I'm very reluctant in any of these things to use AI at all. I'm
Even
kind of
as a starting
anti.
point.
Yeah,
even as my
I'm
anchor.
kind of against these jurisdictions doing it. I know judges have their own foibles, or at least their human foibles, and so yeah, I'm going on the record. I don't like algorithms being used in bail decisions.
Mithil, you and I failed that exam. We picked the wrong answer. We're like, that sounds good. The problem is, Colin, will you throw these are big, big problems. I need some time for it to marinate and really think through all the implications. Like on the spot, like anybody else, I'm going to be like, oh, I see all of, like the benefits of that. But yeah, let it marinate. Okay, see, now that I have your perspective, I'm
But
like,
it's also
and
2026, right? 2028, 2029. It might be a different picture.
yeah, I will say this.
Cool.
When I go to a public bathroom that has one of those sensors, to wash your hands, a lot of those sensors cannot detect like your skin if you're a person of color, which is I used to be like, why do I keep doing this and it won't wash my hands until I saw a video about this. I'm like, holy moly. So if we're not even at the point where the bathroom sink can figure out that there's a human standing in front of it, maybe AI is not the way to go for now. Yeah. Mito, you
AI
were
is going to
saying.
be our downfall anyways. I mean, it's so awesome how powerful it is and the things that we can do if the ethics behind it are solid, right? Like if everyone's just looking to get ahead and whether we're talking about, it legally or technology in general, like the advancement is amazing, but if you're not using it in the right way, people are going to get screwed left and right, regardless. So, in this case, like it's as good as the data is, right? Just like with anything else. If the data is not good or if the data is skewed, like someone's going to be screwed and that sucks. But at least having the AI technology, like if it continues to evolve as it has been, right? To your point, in 2028, it could look different. That would still be great and be beneficial because you can get so much out of that if you use it the right way. But that's the thing that's not happening.
Colin, do you ever think that there'll come a time when AI could basically replace the finder of fact and just be fed all the evidence and data, investigative reports, witness statements, forensics, and spit out a verdict?
Well, it's interesting. I was just discussing this in my wrongful convictions class last night, and I think the consensus we reached was, I don't think we would ever, as a country, be comfortable with AI at trial deciding guilt or not. But I could see down the road AI being used in a post-conviction context where you plug everything in, maybe a conviction review unit, and the AI says, boom, we flagged this as a likely wrongful conviction. I'd be comfortable. I understand. I think we'd all be comfortable. Oh, okay. That would be a useful tool for a conviction review unit
Yeah.
to put it into the AI, put the entire police
Okay,
file, the
please
trial
file.
transcript, and okay, great. 90% of our cases came out clear. We have 10% where the AI is flagging issues, and we devote our resources to looking into those cases and seeing why the AI is saying this is a wrongful conviction. I would love that.
Let's hire some developers in India to make this for us, Colin. Finally make some money off of our book. That's actually brilliant. That's a great idea. I'd wonder how many of these units would be willing to use something like that. How
But
convincing.
even if they didn't, Innocence Project, right? We FOIA,
A
they
hundred
get the whole
percent.
file transcript, we put it in, and they could use it as the Innocence Project to say, okay, these, when they are screening cases.
It's a good it would be a good tool because they get hundreds of applications and it takes manual review and
Not to say they reject the ones that the AI doesn't flag, but oh, okay, this 10% AI flags it. Let's really take those out and say,
Yeah, I think AI is at the point where AI can scan documents and pull the actual information and understand it, I think. Oh, that's crazy. I love it. I love that idea. All right, guys. Well, this has been an interesting and fun and thought-provoking conversation, as it always is. I never know what Colin's going to throw at
I
us.
know.
But it's always something that keeps you thinking. And we'd love to hear your thoughts as well as you hear this episode. You can comment under the post. You can DM us, email us. You can find us through our website. and so many other ways on social media. And but we'd love to hear from you and think and hear your thoughts about AI and criminal justice. All right, guys. Well, you have a good rest of your week. And Colin, I will see you for our, I don't know, fifth episode recording of the week in a couple of hours. We're just turning too sad at this point. Anyhow, all right, you guys stay safe and warm. See you next week.
Take care.
Bye, guys.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.